by picking up where we were last time, that we had said that DNA looks more or less like this. And we had discussed that this implies how DNA does job two. Now, I want to talk about the details of that, but first, before we do DNA replication, I want to do some more features of structure, which are not so obvious from this model. Now, the very first question is about the two strands in this helix. This has a backbone with the bases sticking out. This is a backbone with the bases sticking out. But how are they oriented relative to each other? You may remember that we said that every DNA has a 5' end and a 3' end. So, let's consider what the possibilities are here. So, let's start with a strand. We'll just call it A. I'm going to use the same sequence that's in your notes just to make it easy. Suppose we had a DNA, and I just wrote this, AGC, whatever goes in the middle, TTA. Which end is the 5' end? By convention, it's that end. So this one is 5', left is 5', right is 3'. Now, what about the other strand? Now, we know what the order of bases is. What goes opposite A? Has to be T, C, G, A, T. But now the question is, what about the 3' and 5' ends of the other strand? So one possibility is that the strands are, like, I'm going to write it twice, is that the strands are actually parallel. They both have the same 5' to 3' orientation. And the other is that they are anti-parallel. To make it clear what we mean, I think it's easier to understand this if we use pop beads. So here is short strand of DNA, A, G, C, T. So we know that complementary bases go together, so purple goes with yellow, red goes with green. So one possibility is it's like this. Now you notice we have two ends on the chain. You call whichever one you want, say 5', 3', but we have a male end and a female end. So here, so to speak, both 5' ends are at the same end. This is a parallel molecule. But what if we do it this way? Now, in terms of base pairs, it's the same. Yellow with purple, red with green. But now they're anti-parallel. The 5' end is at opposite ends. Now, we actually know from the X-ray crystallography, which it is, as well as from model building. In X-ray crystallography, if you turn the crystal upside down, it makes no difference. We're not talking about base sequence. We're talking about overall structure. And you can see with this one, the anti-parallel, that if I turn it over, it doesn't make any difference. Basically, the double-stranded molecule has no head and tail end. Each single strand does, but the double doesn't. If this were parallel, on the other hand, if this were a parallel pairing, then the double-stranded molecule would have a head and a tail, which it does not. It also follows from these models, when you try and build them, that the strands have to be anti-parallel. Now, in this model, this is a base pair. This is the next base pair, the next base pair. And this is the sugar phosphate backbone on one side, and this is the sugar phosphate backbone of the other. This model doesn't show everything, but it shows some things very clearly. Now, I haven't painted all of the atoms, but we've painted some of the oxygens here in the chains. And you can see that the oxygens point down here with the sugars and up here. This is distinctly anti-parallel. Now, you don't need to look at it now, but if you go back later, your handout from last time on page 3 has a short section drawn anti-parallel, which is exactly equivalent to this model, and you can get a closer picture of how it works. So the two strands are anti-parallel. Now, why do we care? What's the big deal? It turns out when we get to replication of the DNA, the fact that they're anti-parallel is going to make life much more complicated. So keep that in mind. Now, another thing that this model illustrates that the fiddlestick one does not is that the base pairs are flat. And that they, each base pair, flat one, is on top of the other, although at a slight angle. What's holding this thing together is a whole bunch of weak bonds. The primary ones are the hydrogen bonds between A and T and G and C. But there's also what's called base stacking. And this is an interaction between the electrons in the rings of one pair of bases with the ones above and the ones below. You have a whole bunch of conjugated rings here, so there's an interaction up-down as well as across, which helps stabilize this structure. Now, if you want to see what a real double helix looks like, you probably want to look at a space-filling model, and there are many pictures of that in your texts, on the web, etc. Now, the way I've drawn DNA there, or represented it, or here, we have a primary and a secondary structure, so to speak. But it turns out DNA doesn't look exactly like this either. And you can see why this won't do when you make a few very simple calculations. We know that in E. coli, and these numbers are in the notes, there are about 3 million base pairs. So if there are 3 million base pairs, and it's 4 angstroms between base pairs, you can calculate how long the whole DNA would be. And the whole DNA is about 1.2 millimeters. That is, if you took the whole one DNA molecule from E. coli and stretched it out, it would stretch approximately across the head of a pin. But we know that you can fit 200 E. coli across the head of a pin. Now, we're not talking angels here on a pin. We're talking about real molecules and real bacteria. So we must be able to cram 200 of these into a space across the head of the pin. And the way that happens is that the DNA is supercoiled. It has higher orders of structure. If you think of this like a telephone cord, it's then kinked back on itself. So the DNA is actually folded back on itself, and it can be folded back many times. And we're not going to go into that, but that turns out to be necessary. Now, there are plenty of other features of DNA structure which are interesting, but we're going to leave it at that for now and start considering about some of the implications of the structural features we've already discussed. And I wanted to start with what people call the non-genetical implications. That is, some features of DNA which are exploited in the laboratory. Now, if we go back to our double-stranded DNA, we explained last time that it's held together by pretty weak bonds. So if we use reagents such as chemicals or heat that break weak bonds, we can actually take the DNA apart into its two halves or two single strands, or so to speak, Watson and Crick. This process is called denaturation. So if you start with a double-stranded molecule and you heat it up, you get individual single-stranded molecules. Now, this is called denaturation by analogy with what happens to proteins. When you heat up a protein, it unfolds and is said to be denatured. So when you heat up double-stranded DNA and you get single-stranded DNA, that's also called denaturation. Now, it turns out that not only can you denature DNA, but you can put it back together again. And that's called renaturation. And in addition to denaturing it or renaturing it, you can take two different denatured molecules, mix them together, and see if they'll pair. And that's called hybridization. So we want to look at each of these in turn. What can you learn from denaturing the DNA? What can you learn from renaturing it? Or in particular, renaturing it in a mixture, that is hybridization. So I don't need this for now, so I'm going to move it because I think it's in the way. To this DNA as double-stranded DNA as you heat it up. You can actually measure, if you have many, many molecules and you heat them all up, you can measure the percent that becomes single-stranded as a function of temperature. And what you get is a curve, something like a titration curve. As you heat the DNA up, it remains double-stranded mostly up to a critical point. At that critical point, you've broken enough hydrogen bonds that the DNA falls apart. So that it goes from close to about up to, now you have completely single-stranded DNA. And so there's a sharp transition here. Below this critical temperature, the DNA is double-stranded. Above, it is single-stranded. And the midpoint of this temperature, midpoint of this transition, is called the melting temperature, or the T sub M. So if you've melted the molecule from being rigid, now it's single-stranded floppy. Now, not all DNA molecules have the same TM. If you have a bunch of DNA molecules that are all the same length, they still don't all fall apart at the same critical temperature. It turns out that the critical temperature, the TM, at which they fall apart is a measure of the amount of GC bonds that they have in the DNA. So the TM is proportional to the G plus C content, or the percent G plus C. Now, why should this be so? If you consider a double-stranded DNA, it has GC base pairs and AT base pairs. But what's connecting an A and a T across the double helix? Hydrogen bonds. How many? Two. Not a double bond, but two weak bonds. But what about G and C? That's three hydrogen bonds. So the more GC pairs you have, the more hydrogen bonds you have, and the harder it is to pry the teeth, break all those weak bonds and take the DNA apart. So that's why it's really true that the melting temperature is proportional to the number of hydrogen bonds, which in a normal DNA molecule is proportional to the G plus C. Now, this means that if you want to get the proportions of the bases in your DNA, you don't have to do a chemical analysis a la Chargaff. There's a much easier way. You take your DNA sample and you heat it up and you see what its TM is. At what temperature does it denature? And you compare it to the temperature at which a standard DNA of known GC denatures. And from this, you can actually get the percent of the base pairs which are GC. So suppose you get that the G plus C is 42%. What is the entire base composition? Percent A, percent T, percent G, percent C. What I want you to do is turn to the person next to you and see what it is. See if you agree. Let's make it easy. What's the percent A? You have 30 seconds. Reach the consensus? Let's back up a little. What's the percent G? 21. We know that every time there's a G, there's a C on the other side. So these two have to be equal at 21 each. So the rest is A plus T. So how much A? 29% A. And if it's not obvious to you why this is so, then you should go home and check it out. All right. So from the temperature at which something denatures, we can learn its base composition. What can we learn from renaturation? Well, first of all, the most important part is that DNA will renature. If you heat a protein up until it unfolds and you cool it down, will it refold? Do the egg whites liquefy when you cool off the scrambled eggs?
No.
If you unfold a protein with heat, it remains unfolded. It gets trapped in the unfolded form and will not refold. But this is not true for DNA. Single-stranded DNA, if you cool it down properly, will in fact renature so that each single strand will find its partner. The DNA will renature, the single strands will find their partners, and you will reform the double-stranded DNA. Now, as we've indicated already, renaturation isn't as interesting as hybridization. In hybridization, what you mix is DNA from two different sources. So you have two different samples, and you denature them both. So let's see. Start with an orange DNA and a white DNA. We'll denature them both. Now, of course, you wouldn't have one molecule of each. You'd have many molecules of each, but we're keeping it simple. So you have orange, Watson and Crick, so to speak, and white, Watson and Crick. What happens if you mix it all together and cool it down? If the two DNAs are totally different, then a white Watson can't pair up with an orange Crick. If the DNAs are really different, the only thing that can happen is the white DNA can renature and the orange DNA can renature. But what if the DNAs are really the same? What if they are really two samples of the same DNA? That means the sequence in the two Cricks is the same, sequence in the two Watsons is the same, and the complement of the Cricks. So if the two DNAs are really the same, then you're going to be able to find a hybrid in which, say, white Watson finds orange Crick, and vice versa. But if they're totally different, then you're only going to get pure orange molecules and pure white. Now, what about the in-between situations? It turns out this technology can be used to figure out the relationship between the sequence of the orange DNA and the sequence of the white DNA. If they are similar, but not exactly the same, you can tell how similar they are. Because if the orange and the white are similar, then they will pair up. And they will form hydrogen bonds in the areas where they match. But there will be short sections where they don't match. And those hydrogen bonds won't form. So you can get an incomplete hybrid. The more similar the two DNAs are, the more complete the hybrid is. The less similar they are, the less hybrid. Well, how will you tell how similar this one is to the original? Or let's put it another way. How will you tell how well paired this is? Melted? Meaning, what would happen if you heated this one up? Yeah?
The TM would not be as high?
the TM would not be, assuming that the orange and the white had the same TM, this would have the same?
Lower.
It would be lower because we have less hydrogen bonds. So the less perfect the hybrid is, the lower the TM. So you can figure out from melting it again how perfect the hybrid was. So this kind of procedure is done to measure how similar two DNAs are. Also, in this mixture, there's equal numbers of white and orange single strands. But if you have a mixture which is not even Steven, with, say, many more copies of the orange than the white, then if you let the mixture cool down, well, they hybridize. Let's suppose these white and orange are completely different, but there is more orange, more copies of the orange DNA. When you cool it down, will they hybridize or renature at the same rate? So you have lots more oranges than you have whites. Well, is an orange Crick just as likely to meet an orange Watson as a white Crick a white Watson? No, not anymore. If the concentrations are different, the one that has higher concentration will renature faster because each molecule can find a partner more easily. So from the rate of renaturation, you can get proportions. People don't do that this much anymore, but many classical experiments are based on this. So from either the rate at which renaturation occurs or the extent to which hybridization occurs, you can tell something about concentration or about sequence. Now, there's one other use to this hybridization business, which is perhaps its most important use, and that is for detection. If you have a mixture of enzyme molecules, how do you find out if a particular enzyme is in there? What property of the enzyme do you use? You use its activity, its ability to catalyze a reaction. You supply substrate and you see if you get any product. So enzymes are detected by their catalytic ability. But how do you detect one nucleic acid or another? What property do you use? And you use the ability to hybridize to its complement. So let me do an example here. I don't know if this is going to work, but let's try. So here we have a DNA molecule. It's a little short for demonstration purposes, but you get the idea. So if I had a table, this would stand up, but I don't know if it will, given what we've got here. So this DNA has a particular sequence. How can we tell if it's present in a mixture? Well, what we would do is we would have a short DNA, which is complementary, sometimes to all of it, but usually to a piece of it. Now, the way we detect our target is by adding the complement and seeing if it would stick. And all DNAs have to pair anti-parallel, so it has to go this way, can't go the other way. So we see, does it match? No. But if we let it flop around long enough, in fact, our short DNA will stick to the target because our short DNA is complementary to a piece of the target. And this piece of red tape is significant. The short piece, which is called a probe, always has some sort of tag on it. It's either radioactive, for example, fluorescent, or it has some other tag which allows you to detect it. So you can detect now that your sample trapped the probe, and therefore we know what's in the mix. Now, probes are short. They're not usually this short, but they're often shorter than the target which they detect. And we will meet many, many examples of the use of probes to find a target DNA. So DNAs then are identified by their ability to hybridize to their complement. Now, that covers the non-genetical aspects of implications of DNA structure. And now I want to come back to genetical. So let me ask before I go on if there are any questions. Yes?
What's the test to tell whether or not DNA is single-stranded?
How do you tell if DNA is single-stranded or double-stranded? There are many different ways to tell. One way is by sensitivity to enzymes. One is by change in UV absorbance. Yeah?
Do the hybridizations that form when the molecules are the same, do they not form a helix?
Here?
Yeah.
This would form a helix. I just wanted to make it a little clear that these were completely hydrogen bonded. But these should have been written, if what you're saying is, should we have written it as a helix? Yes, like this. That's right. Okay. So now let's come back to the genetical implications of this structure, this DNA structure. Yesterday we said that it seems reasonably obvious that the way DNA replicates is it comes apart into its two complementary halves, and each half is the template to make the missing half. Well, how do you show whether this is or is not correct? Shortly after the Watson-Crick structure was published, Meselson and Stahl did a very famous experiment establishing that, in fact, this is how DNA replicates. And that's what I want to talk about next. And this is outlined on handout 11.1. And actually, I'd be happy to draw it on this picture, on this clean board, if somebody will get it for me. But I can't reach it. Thank you very much. Okay, great. Okay. So, nah. Well, I think I can hold on to it. So, if we look at handout 11.1, we have here in the middle where it says possible modes of DNA replication. Now, I didn't show the original molecule, but suppose we had an original molecule that looked like that. What we have just suggested is that what happens is that DNA molecule comes apart, and now, using new raw materials, we link up nucleotides, and we make the complement. I'll draw it dotted because it's dotted on your handout. It would be a continuous chain, but so that we would now have two molecules, each half old and half new. Now, this is called semi-conservative replication. And this is sort of the obvious solution, but it doesn't mean it works that way. So what are the other possibilities? Well, one possibility is that somehow the old DNA never comes apart. Or if it does, it only does so temporarily. And when you finish DNA replication, you have one complete old molecule and one completely new molecule. Same sequence, but made completely out of new parts. And that's called conservative replication because the old molecule is completely conserved. Now, there's a third possibility. It's a whole class of possibilities. But what distinguishes the third situation is that when you get finished with replication, each molecule has double-stranded sections that are old and double-stranded sections that are new. Now, you notice here that each complete chain, each complete single-stranded chain is either all old or all new. In dispersive, that is not so. So the third version, and we're just drawing one example of it. So you have some chains, say, that look like this. And some like this. So. Now, the point of these third model, notice, is that each individual single strand has both old and new sections. And there are many variants on this model, but they all have that feature in common. So how are you going to tell which of these it is? Whether you have semi-conservative, conservative, or dispersive? it's sort of clear that you need something that is the equivalent of orange chalk. What's that going to be? Radioactivity is the obvious solution, but it turns out not to be the solution. It's close, but no cigar. Because you do indeed use an isotope to do this, but you use an isotope which is characterized by density and not by radioactivity. And the short answer for why is that if you use an isotope of unusual density, then you can actually separate a new old molecule from an old old and a new new. If you use radioactivity, you would have to somehow spread the molecules out and count the radioactivity in each molecule, which is not feasible. So let's explain the experiment they did and then think about the nitty-gritty of how they separated the molecules. So I'm going to draw that out over here. This is written in the notes in one of the diagrams, but it's not on the handout. But it's pretty simple. So what you actually do is you start with cells. And what they did was to grow them in medium containing a heavy isotope of nitrogen, N15, for a long time. Now one presumes at the end of this period, all the nitrogen virtually in the DNA is N15. Then you transfer the bacteria to fresh medium, and you grow them for one generation, allowing them to double their DNA once. In medium, where the nitrogen is plain old N14. So we've grown them a long time so that the starting DNA has all N15. And then we've waited one generation. So the DNA is doubled once. And the question is, which of these cases do we have? So how are you going to get that? So now you have the cells with the DNA in them. But now you have to break open the cells and get an extract, as we explained last time. And then from that, you have to separate the DNA. You have to get the DNA out. We actually have to fractionate the DNA by density. So the extract is a solution of DNA, basically. But now you want to separate the DNAs in there by density and see which case have you got. Now, how are you going to tell them apart? It turns out, by the way, that these two DNAs, completely N15 and completely N14, differ by 1% in density. The way you do it is by a variation on ultracentrifugation. Now, if you look at the top of your handout, we've compared the kind of ultracentrifugation we've talked about before with this new kind. The kind we talked about before is called sedimentation velocity. When we talked about using the ultracentrifuge before, you had a solution. The solution often had a gradient in it of density or concentration, but you put your samples on the top. And then you turn on the centrifuge, and the material moves, is through the solution, and how far it moves is proportional. If you look at D, what it separates, it separates by a ratio of mass to shape. So if you have a whole bunch of balls, for example, that is all the same shape, the big balls will go faster, the small balls will not go as fast, and as shown underneath afterwards, the small balls will be in one place and the big balls will be somewhere else. Now, in this procedure, you put your material on the top. If the solution has a gradient in it, it's there already. You don't turn on the centrifuge for very long, because what happens if you run the centrifuge too long? Everything ends up on the bottom. Because you're separating by size or mass over shape. And you could separate, for example, big and small balls. And what you're actually measuring is velocity, how fast things move down the tube. Now, the other technique that they used here is called sedimentation equilibrium density. Equilibrium density centrifugation. Now, this is different in that you separate not small and large balls, but dense balls and light balls, like ping pong balls and golf balls that are the same size but different in density. But of course, they weren't that different. So here we've got different colors of balls symbolizing different density. Now, in this case, you actually just put them in a solution. And the gradient will be generated during centrifugation. So the gradient forms during the experiment, and you put the sample in the solution, not on top. And now, again, you spin the centrifuge, but for a very long time, until the system reaches equilibrium. Now, what will happen? You have in this solution a heavy salt. The usual one is cesium chloride. Now, the thing about cesium chloride is that it's dense enough that it concentrates on the bottom of the tube. But it's not dense enough to actually be... I think this should be two, but anyway. It's dense enough so that it actually is more concentrated at the bottom of the top, but it's not dense enough to be centrifuged into a pellet. So the cesium chloride generates a density gradient within this test tube. Now, what happens to your ball? If the ball is lighter than the surrounding fluid, it floats. If it's heavier than the surrounding fluid, it sinks. So you have a density gradient generated by the cesium chloride, and the balls float or sink until they are in the matching area. So the more dense balls will accumulate at one spot, and the lighter balls will accumulate elsewhere. So these would be less dense, or lighter, and the ones near the bottom would be heavier. Now, what happens if you spin this forever? Nothing. Once it reaches equilibrium, it just stays there. So you can't spin this one too long. If you spin sedimentation velocity too long, everything just ends up on the bottom of the tube. But here, everything will not. Because you're basically spinning it until you reach an equilibrium with the light balls floating at one level and the heavier balls floating at another level. And this allows you to separate your DNAs. Now, what Meselson and Stahl did first was they took an artificial mixture of DNA which had only N14 and DNA from here, from cells that had been grown a long time in N15. So they isolated DNA from these two batches of cells, mixed them, and put them in the centrifuge. And when you do that, you can actually separate N14-containing DNA from N15 DNA. So the two of them separate, and you get two bands, one corresponding to the N14 DNA and one corresponding to the N15. So even though this difference is only 1%, you can actually detect it. So now let's go back, look at their experiment. So they took DNA after, let's see what you should get. If your DNA replicates semi-conservatively, what should the centrifuge band look like, centrifuge tube look like, after you extract the DNA and run the centrifuge? One band or two?
One.
Because all your DNA is of intermediate or hybrid density. So it would look like this. Now, what if you had conservative replication? Now you'd have a mixture of some heavy DNA, so-called heavy N15 DNA, and so-called light DNA, or just N14. So this would be like a mixture. Two bands. Now, what if you have dispersive replication? Well, you'd probably have one band, but you would now have a collection of DNAs, each of which was part N14 and N15. So you might have a sharp band, but you might just have a very broad band because you'd have DNAs with different proportions of N14 and N15. But you would be intermediate, no question. Well, when they actually did the experiment, they found that they grew the DNA, they grew the cells in N15 a long time, one generation in N14, took the cells, extracted the DNA and fractionated it, and they got two bands. They got one band. One band of intermediate density. Okay, can we rule anybody out? It can't be this one. This one's out. Now, what is so clever about this experiment is that not only does it rule one's possibility in, but it also rules the other possibilities out. Because it wasn't sufficient to find information supporting semi-conservative. You also had to get data that was against conservative and dispersive. So how are they going to rule this one out? This doesn't seem very likely, but how are you going to rule it out? So one way they did it was to repeat the experiment with one variation. They grew the bacteria for two generations. Same idea. Long time in N15, two generations, which means what's the difference? What is the DNA has to replicate twice? So the DNA has to replicate in whatever mechanism it does twice, not once. Then they got the cells, they broke it open, they took the extract, and they fractionated. So I have a question for you, which is, what results do you expect if it's semi-conservative? I'm not going to do all the cases. You can try that when you get home. But if replication is semi-conservative at the end of a second replication, how many bands and of what density? So try that with the person next to you. How many? Two generations. How many bands? And what density? Really helps to talk to somebody. Shouldn't be shy. Did you figure it out? You have to draw it. Draw what happens. No. Take this one. If you can't figure it out, draw it out. You know what happens after one generation. What happens after two? Okay, let's take a vote. How many people think you'll get one band after two generations? Two bands. Three bands. Okay, we still have three. More than three. Too early in the morning. Okay. So most people say two, but some people say three. Now, somebody who said two, how did you figure it out? You can blame it on the other guy if you're wrong.
When you have two of the old strands that are mixed with the new,
Well, this is what it looks like after one generation, right? This is what it looks like. Okay, so what happens if this stuff replicates? It has to come apart, right?
All separates, and then you have the new and the lighter one that combines with all four. Like, all four separate,
Well, the same thing happens over there. So we're just going to worry about one of them, but it's the same with both. And then what's the new strand made out of?
The new.
New material, right?
Yeah.
So what's the new material, N14 or N15?
N14.
It's 14, which is white. So it's going to look like, whoops, it's going to look like this. So at the end, we're still going to have some hybrid DNA, but now we're going to have, after two generations, some all-light DNA. Because we made a light partner, and then it came apart and made itself a light partner. Do we have any threes who still think three? Or have a question? Okay. So the answer then is you're going to have two. You're going to get two from here also. You're now going to have light, light, and heavy, light, but no heavy, heavy. Now, excuse me? Question? Now, there are problems in the problem book which allow you to do variations on this and see it. Meselson Stahl, in fact, did this experiment, and this is what they got. After two generations, they had two bands, one light light and one light heavy, or hybrid. Does that rule out dispersive? What do you think would happen with dispersive? You would think you would still have one, it just it would get lighter and lighter as the proportion of light got heavier and heavier. So the second generation experiment rules this one out and is also consistent with semi-conservative. So everything fits semi-conservative, but they actually did it one more. If you look at your handout, there is actually one more case described here. Remember we talked about denaturation? The idea that you can heat the DNA up and take apart the two strands? Well, you can actually do that. We're talking here about separating what is called native or undenatured DNA. What if you denatured each of these samples? Could you tell the difference? If you denatured either of these, would the result be any different? Notice it would not. In both cases, you would have equal numbers of single heavy strands and single light strands. But what if you denatured this one? Then all of your strands would be intermediate. So in addition to doing the experiment of looking at native DNA, they denatured the DNA and looked at that. So the difference here is you take the extract, you denature it, and then you do the fractionation by density. And that result is explained here in the handout, and I won't walk you through it. You can try it yourself and be sure it fits. So the conclusion of the Meselson-Stahl experiment is that DNA replicates semi-conservatively. And all the information we have, in fact, matches that. Okay. So the whole reason for bringing this up is how does one DNA molecule make two? How do you double the instructions so an E. coli can divide and each daughter cell gets a complete set of instructions? So suppose you wanted to analyze DNA replication in a test tube. So you put DNA in a test tube because you know it can denature and each half can act as template. And you add the raw materials. Now, what would you need to make DNA so far, we think? You'd need deoxy-ATP, deoxy-GTP, deoxy-CTP, and deoxy-TTP. You'd need the deoxy versions of the right mono, what I'm going to call just XMP, meaning the appropriate monophosphate, either the T monophosphate, the G, the C, but it has to be the deoxy one. So if you put these two together in a test tube, will you get any DNA made? You will get Zip-O. What did you forget? Ah, you need an enzyme, do you? You always need an enzyme. So it turns out you don't need just one enzyme. You need a whole bunch of them. We're going to concentrate on a few of them, but you actually need a very large number of enzymes because you have to pry the DNA open in addition to everything else. So you need a lot of enzymes. We forgot something else, too. Whenever you want to make, let's say you want to make a macromolecule, well, you have to line the monomers up, right? You have to worry about order. Do we know how you get everything lined up? That's what the Meselson-Stahl experiment is all about. That the DNA itself lines up the new nucleotides and provides the ordering information. So we know how you do that. Then you have to worry about the actual chemical reaction. You have to worry about the enzymes that actually catalyze. If you have everything lined up, you have to catalyze the joining of one nucleotide to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. So that you need an enzyme. Just like you do if you're making something small. To put things together or take things apart, you need an enzyme. But there's one more thing. Will every reaction take place in a cell if you provide the right enzyme where you get the right product? No. Is it going to go this way or this way? Yeah. You aren't rid of delta G yet. You have to worry about the energy issue. Does the reaction you want to take place, is it uphill or downhill? Negative or positive delta G zero? And if it's positive, you're going to put some energy in from somewhere. So we have to think about all of these things. We've solved this problem. We've considered how you order the nucleotides. But what about the enzymes and the energy? So I want to talk about energy first, and then I'll come back and do enzymes. And the energy issue is outlined on handout 11.2. Okay, so let's consider the obvious reaction. Let's say we have a trinucleotide. Now, I've left out the phosphates. There's a phosphodiester bond from the sugar of A to G and from G to C. And there's a hydroxyl here on the end. Now, we want to add on one more nucleotide. Now, in this picture, there is no template. But let's, in a real case, of course, we'd have to have DNA to act as the template. So the DNA template would have a T here, and a C here, and a G here. Let's suppose it has an A next. So if it has an A next, what nucleotide do we need? To go with A? This DNA, so we need T. If this were RNA, we would use U. So we want T. Now, we're talking DNA here, so all these sugars are deoxy. If we were talking RNA, the basic setup would be the same, but all these sugars would be ribo. So if it were RNA, it would be ribo sugars and U not T. But let's stick to DNA. So this is the monophosphate. So the obvious thing is to make a bond here. The phosphate already has an ester to the sugar. Let's make another ester. We'll have a phosphodiester bond connecting the two sugars. That's the obvious thing to do, and we'll remove water. I should have written that on the side about the ribo and the U, so we'll just leave that off. Okay, and what would happen? We would remove water here, and we would get now a nucleotide, one longer, and more. Okay. And where would we get our T monophosphate from? Remember we said last time that when you eat DNA, you break it down? You actually have monophosphates lying around, either from what you ate or from synthesis. So that's not a problem. Well, the catch is the delta G for this reaction, as you can see on your handout. Haha, I think I left it out. Never put it in. It's actually not plus. Yeah, it's about plus 7. Yeah, it's written underneath. So the delta G for this reaction is around plus 7 kilocalories per mole. Now, it turns out you have an enzyme for this. Which way does this reaction probably run in cells? That-a-way. Because downhill is that-a-way. In fact, the function of this reaction is not to make polynucleotides, it's to take them apart, to hydrolyze them. This reaction actually occurs this way, and it's the recycling reaction. This is what occurs when you eat DNA or RNA. The appropriate enzyme knocks off the nucleotides one at a time, giving you a supply of mononucleotides, which you will then reuse. So this reaction is used to break down what you eat, not to help you make DNA and RNA. So how are we going to make DNA and RNA? This is reaction one. We want to achieve the net effect of pushing this to the left. If we want to do that, what do we have to put in? And we need energy from somewhere. Where do you usually get energy from? Good old ATP. So if we split some ATP somehow, maybe we can use that energy to drive this in the other direction and make DNA. Now, how many ATP are we going to have to split to add on one nucleotide? If we just split one phosphate off of ATP, how much free energy do we get approximately?
Seven.
We get about 7 kilocalories, right? So we would have 7 kilocalories pushing this way, 7 kilocalories pushing that way, and the net is zero. So if we want the reaction to go strongly in the desired direction, we actually have to split two phosphates off of ATP to get enough free energy to do exactly what we want. So reaction two has to somehow be coupled to reaction one. And you notice what it is. 2 ATP plus 2 water give you 2 ADP. I want to check your copy because mine has a typo. I'll see if yours does or not. No. Fixed it. Okay. So what we've done here is rather than knock two phosphates off one ATP, we have used two ATPs, knock one phosphate off of each of them, net effect minus 14 kilocalories. 14 downhill, 7 uphill, we're way down. Now, it's all very well and good to say, okay, reaction two gives us the energy to drive reaction one, but how do we couple these two reactions so that the energy from reaction two drives reaction one? We don't carry out these two reactions. We actually carry out three different ones whose net effect is the same. And that's shown in the remaining three reactions and in the diagram on the bottom of your handout, which I've written here on the board. The easiest way to explain this probably is using this summary diagram. So what I've done here is to write on an energy scale the reaction we were just talking about. We said that if you start with a trinucleotide and a monophosphate and you make one phosphoester bond, that's an uphill reaction. Okay. But what if you start with a triphosphate? A triphosphate has two extra phosphates. What if you knock off both of them? You break one phosphodiester bond, you break second phosphodiester bond. How much delta G? Minus 14 to push something that's only plus 7. So if we start with a triphosphate and knock off two phosphates and make the bond we want, the net effect will be downhill, negative delta G, and that's what we want. And this is what happens. This actually takes two steps and two enzymes, but the net effect is downhill. There's only one problem. How are we going to get from monophosphate to triphosphate? This is where the ATP comes in. The energy of the ATP comes in to put these two extra phosphates on the monophosphate. So one ATP adds one phosphate, the other ATP adds the second phosphate. So that's what this other reaction here is. This is not properly drawn on an energy scale. It should probably be in a box. That what is pushing monophosphate to triphosphate is the hydrolysis of 2 ATP. And the energy derived from that is sufficient to phosphorylate the ATP, the nucleotide monophosphate. Now, that reaction itself has a delta G0 of about zero, because the total number of high energy bonds doesn't change in this reaction. They're just moved around. And if you now consider this reaction here, where you add on the a monophosphate starting from a triphosphate, that takes place in two steps, which are written here as reaction 4 and reaction 5. Reaction 4 also has a negative, a zero delta G approximately, but reaction 5 is very negative. So reaction 5 is really what pulls the whole operation. So if we look at reaction 4 again, we've got a trinucleotide, we've got a triphosphate. Now, we're going to make a phosphoester bond between the innermost phosphate and the hydroxyl on the end, this being the 3' end. And we're going to break off pyrophosphate. So this is different from what we've done before. Before, we always knocked a phosphate off or added a phosphate. But here, what we're knocking off is two combined phosphates. And these are connected. And so what you're going to get is the tetranucleotide and pyrophosphate, which is usually written PPI. And there's an enzyme for each of the reactions that I've written. There's an enzyme for reaction 3, of course, the upward arrow. And there's a reaction here. Now, what I just did is catalyzed by the enzyme called DNA polymerase. It just added on one nucleotide to the 3' end of a growing chain, and it released pyrophosphate. Now, this is about delta G zero, zero. Why? When I started, I had the number of high energy bonds I have as a result of this reaction is essentially the same, because I broke one between the two N-phosphates and the third, but I made one when I added on the A. But I got pyrophosphate. Now, reaction 5 is just the hydrolysis of pyrophosphate to give you two inorganic phosphate, and the enzyme that does that is called pyrophosphatase. Now, pyrophosphatase is around all the time. It's ubiquitous. So pyrophosphate, so to speak, is dead in the water. As soon as pyrophosphate is generated, it is hydrolyzed. And this is a negative delta G of about minus 7, because we've broken one phosphodiester bond. Now, you can think of it that the overall delta G of these two reactions together is negative. The overall delta G zero is negative, and therefore the whole thing goes. The other way to think about it, though, is the DNA polymerase reaction. Why is it never reversed? What happens to the product? Kaput. This product is pyrophosphate is constantly removed. And if that's what pulls this reaction, is the removal of pyrophosphate. So you can think of it in terms of delta G. You can think of it in terms of Le Chatelier's principle or mass action. But either way, the net result is that the addition of nucleotides is irreversible. Practically speaking.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, we just sort of solved the energy problem. That by bumping the nucleotide up to a triphosphate, courtesy ATP, and then knocking off two phosphates as we add on to the chain, the net addition to the chain is negative, and we can actually make DNA. Well, you may remember we said much earlier that the two strands of the DNA are anti-parallel, and this was going to lead to trouble. We are now about to hit that trouble. So perhaps the easiest way to explain this is to start out with some DNA. This is diagrammed on 11-3. We won't do all the details today, but we'll do some of the basics. Now, in the fish picture in 11-3, we have a double-stranded DNA molecule that we want to replicate. I think I'll draw it over here. And the two strands are anti-parallel. Now, how do we do replication? You might think that you just took the two strands completely apart, but you don't. You have to take them apart a little bit at a time. So, I now realize that I probably should write out some actual bases to make it clearer what we're about to do. And you have, actually, this example is in your notes, that suppose you have a short DNA, and I've written it this way, AGCTTAG, and its complement. Okay. So in the usual way we write it, the top strand is written 5 prime to 3 prime, and the bottom one is written anti-parallel 3 prime to 5 prime. So the first thing we have to do is unzip the DNA. So if we do that, let's separate the two strands. And now we want to make the complement to the two strands. All DNA polymerases only add to the 3 prime end of the chain. No DNA polymerase will add to the 5 prime end. That means that all synthesis must go in the 5 prime to 3 prime direction. Now let's see how that plays out here. Look at the bottom strand. If we want to make the top, what's the first base we need? Is it A or G? It's A, because every strand must grow from its 5 prime end, adding on to its 3 prime end. So we have to start here with A, and onto its 3 prime end we add a G, and onto that a C, and onto that a T, and so forth, 5 prime to 3 prime. No sweat. However, what about the other strand? We always have to start with the 5 prime end of the new strand. So we have to start down at this end. We have to start with C. So we have to do this. Now I've written it upside down. You don't have to, but I find it very helpful because what's the sequence of the bottom strand? It obviously starts at the C end and not at the T end, because we all read right to left. So if you write the complementary strand upside down, obviously you start at its right side. So this is obviously CTAAGCT and not TCGAATC. Okay. So the easiest way to solve this problem would be if you completely unzip the DNA. If we completely unzip this DNA, then we can make the complement to one side from the bottom and the complement to one side from the top. But the DNA is too long. If you did that, it would get all tangled up and messed up and broken. So you can't do that. So as shown on the handout, you have to unzip the DNA a little bit. So once you unzip the DNA a little bit, I brought a little Velcro demonstration here. Okay, so we unzip our DNA a little bit. So now we want to put in the complement to each side. So my browner strand here, or the left strand on your handout, no problem. We can just make the complement. Now what about on the other side? So let's do that. Let's put in some DNA. Get my arrows right. Okay. So we're going to put it at anti-parallel. This side goes that way. Side goes opposite. Now, what are we going to do on the other side? Where are we going to start synthesis? We have to start from the bottom because this one went this way. So we have to start at the 5' end of the new strand and go up. So we're going to have to start down here a little bit and move up. And that's what's shown in picture 2. I mean, in your second picture, I think, on the handout. Be sure we match this up right. Yeah. So that's picture number 3. So then what we have to do is open it up a little bit more. Now what? So that's picture C. And now in D, what are we going to do? Well, we don't have any problem with one of my sides. This DNA, this is the 3' end. No problem. It can just keep growing. This is the one shown on your handout on the left side. So that's no problem. We just keep growing. But now on the right-hand side on your handout, where are we going to start? We can't grow this chain from its bottom. What we have to do is start over again, further down. We have to back up again. This is sometimes called retrograde or discontinuous synthesis, because each time I unzip, I have to start from the bottom of the new piece and work my way up on one of the sides of the DNA. Now, so what? If I kept going when I got finished, my strand on the right would have a continuous complement. The left on your handout. But on the other side, this strand would have a discontinuous complement. It would have multiple short pieces instead of a continuous complement. So we need one more enzyme here. We need an enzyme to connect each of these short pieces. Now, on your handout, what you want to do is skip steps 5 and 6, which involve some complications we don't want to get into. But what we're saying is that if you get to stage D, you have a continuous complement on the left side, but a discontinuous complement on the right side. And now you need this new enzyme called ligase, and it's going to join your loose ends. And it's going to convert the picture into G. And now we can just repeat. Now, this problem you would never run into if DNA polymerase was more reasonable, or if you had two different DNA polymerases, one that added 3' to 5', and one that added 5' to 3'. But you don't. So let me just sort of convince you briefly why one enzyme can't do both. Here is, in one representation,